So hello and welcome back to the Fatigue Super Conference. I'm Claire, the head of research at the Optimum Health Clinic, and today I'm really thrilled to be talking to Dr. Jodie Deshaw. So Dr. Deshaw is an internationally recognised practitioner, author, researcher, and a pioneering clinical herbalist. She's widely known for her pioneering work in the world of plant-based medicinal approach to autism, Lyme disease, biotoxin illness, and chronic inflammatory response syndrome, and camel milk medicinal protocols. Dr. Deshaw holds a PhD in integrative medicine, is a SERS Shoemaker certified practitioner, board certified in integrative pediatrics, and licensed doctor of occupational therapy in neurology. She's a holistic health practitioner and a registered herbalist with over 25 years of clinical experience. Dr. Deshaw is a member of ILEDS and has been a Lyme literate clinician for over a decade. And Dr. Deshaw brings her love of Ayurveda and Western herbs to her work as a clinical herbalist and has created her own line of proprietary herbal medicinal formulas used exclusively with her patients. She specializes in all natural, plant-based and individual genetic customized treatment options for autism, Lyme and biotoxin illness. And she's a founder and director of Bionexus Health Clinic, Apothecary and Biodynamic Herb Farm. And the Bionexus formulations are available to practitioners worldwide. Dr. Deshaw comes from a multicultural background, is well-traveled and works for families in over 50 countries worldwide, utilizing local resources, dietary nuances and honoring cultural traditions. And finally, Dr. Deshaw is currently pursuing a postdoctoral intensive in immunology at Harvard Medical School and has authored the book, The Bionexus Approach to Biotoxin Illness, a step-by-step guide to sustainable plant-based treatment options. So Dr. Deshaw, welcome to the Fatigue Conference this morning.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Fantastic. So I just wanted to kick off with you talk of your own journey with biotoxin illness through your health and your son's health condition. So I was just wondering if you'd be happy to share a little of your experience and what brought you to specialize in this area.
Yes, of course. And I'll be brief. My pregnancy was complicated with tremendous trauma from sudden death of a sibling and the events of 9/11. I'm grateful for his survival, but my husband worked in the South Tower on the 42nd floor. It was 10 or so hours before he was found, injured but alive and sent home while I was seven and a half months pregnant. Additionally, in hindsight, we found out that my son was born with gestational Lyme. A vaccine injury at 18 months was the straw that broke the camel's back. He stopped progressing and fell into what appeared to be an autism spectrum disorder. However, the diagnostic discrepancies were so many that I questioned the diagnosis right from the start. Biomedical treatments made very little difference. His condition got worse until one day at approximately 6.5 years of age, he lost the use of his left leg, developed excruciating pain in his pelvis, and ended up in a wheelchair. From genetic experts to cancer specialists, had no answers. We finally explored and arrived at various diagnoses, PANS, PANDAS, Lyme, 11 co-infections, biotoxin illness, which is also known as CIRS, or chronic inflammatory response syndrome, lack of growth, failure to thrive. As we progressed with treatment, the recovery was pretty sawtooth, but definitely trending upwards. Astonishing cognitive gains, full recovery from autism, PANS, tick-borne diseases, and SIRS. The herbal protocols I had created for my son were so effective that I decided to make those available to my patients and the many practitioners who requested the same. I'm happy to report my son is now in medical school and hopes to earn his specialization in immunology and join Bionexus Health after residency. I mean, I look forward to that day with immense pride and gratitude.
Oh, amazing. What an amazing story and way to give back to the community as well. And I just wondered if you could explain to our audience the concept of biotoxins and how that might contribute to chronic fatigue, autism, or the more complex presentations in that we might see in clinic.
Yeah, excellent question. And we'll take some time to explain. Dr. Shoemaker's body of work has been a game changer for thousands. here's what we know so far, right? The body acquires biological toxins from various microbes, also from contaminated food, water, air, insect bites. Approximately 27% of the population have a genetic HLA system predisposition where, due to inherited immune responses, immune response genes, the HLA-DR, the human leukocytic antigen DR on chromosome 6 that confer immunocompromise due to repeated or longer exposure and defective antigen presentation. Now, this inherited faulty mechanism of the innate immune system continues to be activated, generating pro-inflammatory compounds like cytokines. It seems to be stuck on repeat, but the adaptive immune system, however, it just never responds. Well, now what happens is the inflammatory response induces suppression of gene activity associated with lowered levels of a protein called as CD3D. It's a critical encoded membrane protein that prevents an antigen-presenting cell, which is called as a dendritic cell of your innate immune system, from making a critical connection with the naive T cell of your adaptive immunity, which is a necessary step in the sequence of a T lymphocyte cell in your secondary lymphoid organs, telling a B lymphocyte cell to start making specific antibodies. No interaction, no antibodies. No antibodies means immunocompromise. Okay, now, yeah. So further to this, it's also important to understand the complications of biotoxin illness. Proliferative physiology include metabolic acidosis, pulmonary hypertension, Treg, the regulatory T cell deficiency, insulin resistance, neuronal injury in the brain, endocrine imbalances, dysregulation of the immune system as well. Now here I would like to mention that most biotoxins are extremely small molecules that are capable of moving from cell to cell through cell membranes without being carried in the bloodstream, which means they are difficult or nearly impossible to find in standardized or standard blood tests. Let's talk briefly about GENI, right? That is gene expression inflammation explained. Now, GENI is the only test that shows both the ribosomal and the mitochondrial gene injury associated with resultant metabolic hypometabolism and aerobic glycolysis, which you may know as Warburg effect, or more commonly known as reduced cellular energy production. So it is of great importance to note that the CD3D protein suppression is also commonly seen in chronic fatigue illnesses. SIRS would be one, of course, but CFSME, fibromyalgia, Lyme disease, these leading the way. Additionally, mitochondrial and immune compromise issues are also commonly seen and have been extensively studied in autism, haven't they?
Yeah.
Over 90% of my patients with autism also have PAMS.
Right.
And SIRS is a huge trigger for PAMS. The brain damage, the multinuclear atrophy associated with CIRS is similar to the basal ganglia involvement seen in PANS, PANDAS type issues. Marcon's, the multiple antibiotic resistant coagulase negative staph, the sinus-based infectious colonization of resistant staph bacteria that is associated with neuropeptide deficiencies in biotoxin illness, these Marcon's secrete two toxins that cross the blood-brain barrier. So eradication of Marcon's usually results in significant cognitive and behavioral gains in my autistic patients. So I hope I was able to tie in these various chronic conditions for you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an amazingly complete answer there. And I was wondering, sort of to touch on, you know, you sort of mentioned the cell-to-cell transmission and the kind of biotoxin maybe not passing into the bloodstream. So that makes it quite hard to detect from a standard blood work point of view. So how do you like to monitor SIRS in your clinic or sort of biotoxin illness? Do you use lab testing? Do you use more of a clinical diagnosis? What are your preferences at the moment in your practice?
Both actually, Claire. Depending on patient preference, global location as well. In many developing and developed countries, testing is not available or highly cost prohibitive. So that leaves us with good old-fashioned medicine that relies on in-depth history with critical attention to detail. This should include personal medical history, environmental history of residents, residences, workplaces, therapy offices. You know, children on the spectrum often spend many, many hours a day in ABA therapy and other therapies. So it's important. Schools, vehicles, school buses, vacations, any vaccinations, any traumas, etc. Mm-hmm. So depending on finances, testing involves the visual contrast sensitivity testing, nasal swab for Marcons, fungi, biofilm. If possible, then Dr. Shoemaker's blood work panel, urine and stool testing for overall toxin load for detoxification considerations. And there's also GENI and additional genetic testing that's available.
Brilliant. Yeah. And I guess furthermore, sort of one concept that I often explain to my clients is that having a cold or fever, never having a cold, a common cold or fever is not necessarily a good thing. Could you sort of elaborate on this and what some other key signs that you might see in clinic that might suggest that someone's immune system might be dysregulated?
Yes, of course. Buckle your seatbelt a bit. The second your body detects something that is a pathogen and can cause disease, your immune system starts to work. The body sends a first non-specific wave of attack mediated through your innate immune mechanisms to kill the microbe invader detected. This occurs within a few hours to days, and you get symptoms like pain, inflammation, malaise. If this doesn't work, next, the immune system starts to learn additional details about the enemy and sends a large, highly specific second wave of reinforcements through adaptive immunity mechanisms to kill what is left. Now, here you can experience fevers, fatigue, and other symptoms of a robust immune response. Studies have shown that Lyme disease can suppress the immune system. Lyme disease bacteria suppressed host complement mediated killing and neutrophil derived antimicrobial responses, including induction of antimicrobial peptides. Spirochetes can undergo non-inheritable transcriptional reprogramming events, ultimately favoring Lyme disease persistence in that particular individual. Bacteria like mycoplasma that often exist as a co-infection, and I see this in lab studies as well in my patients. So studies have shown they can suppress the IgM levels in afflicted individuals. Often I see mycoplasma titers as high as 7,000 to 8,000, however, IgG, which when treated affords significant relief from associated symptoms instead of ignoring this clue and, you know, setting this aside, oh, it's an old infection, et cetera. In chronic inflammatory response syndrome or biotoxin illness, there are three layers of defective antibody formation and immune dysregulation, as I've explained a little bit earlier. Lastly, there's also the problem of induced T cell energy in people with the chronic infections, chronic illness. What happens is the adaptive immune cells that can kill bacteria and the cells infected with bacteria are T cells. But naive or inactive T cells in our bloodstream need to be converted to effector T cells in order for them to kill the antigen or microbe. Now, in order for this to happen, since it's like activating a self-multiplying antimicrobial grenade, there is a safety mechanism or a two-signal mechanism of activation. This tissue sentinel cell, there is a tissue sentinel cell, the dendritic cell, which first comes in contact with the microbe. And this is also called as the antigen-presenting cell, as I mentioned a little bit earlier. So it presents the antigen to the T cell using a class 2 MHC molecule. If it matches, then that's signal 1, and it begins activating the T cell. A second signal, called as a co-stimulatory signal, is essential for full activation and clonal expansion or the proliferation of the T cell to mount a defense against this invader antigen microbe. Mm-hmm. With immune suppression, there often isn't enough oomph left to generate enough of a danger response for the expression of these co-stimulatory receptors. So a naive T cell that's ligated with just one signal, and when it fails to receive a second one, will either undergo apoptosis or cellular death, or worse, it becomes non-responsive or anergic. So in future, even if it comes across a co-stimulatory signal, you know, a danger signal, it will fail to activate and doesn't become into an effector T cell. So poor adaptive immune response, poor symptoms like fevers. So very complex. That's why, sorry, that's why I always say it's important to have a practitioner who sees the full 360.
Absolutely, and understands as much as possible about how different parts of the system, the immune system, really overlap. And I guess that kind of goes to sort of our next question about immune boosting and immune modulating. So we've seen a lot, particularly in the current pandemic, a lot of marketing around certain herbal medicines and vitamins to really boost the immune system. So could you explain the difference perhaps between immune boosting, immune modulating, and the nuances there of why you would pick, why would you would want to modulate the immune system rather than really ramp up the immune system?
Yes, of course. Yes, another good question and a very important question. Studies demonstrate that immune boosting herbs like echinacea, astragalus, etc., stimulate immune cells. Now, this has been quantified by CD69 expression, the molecule, on CD4 positive and CD8 positive immune T cells. This activation takes place within 24 hours of ingestion of these herbs and continues for at least 7 days. Studies show the CD69 may determine patterns of cytokine release as well as homing and migration of activated lymphocytes. Now, in our target patient population that we are speaking of today, high levels of inflammatory agents spur the immune system into constant activity. Initially, the immune system raises its defenses against foreign substances only. With prolonged inflammatory stress, however, the exhausted immune system can direct friendly fire against its host and attack the body's own tissues, thus establishing your classical autoimmune response. To be noted is these three herbs in the study had an additive or cumulative effect on the CD69 expression when used in combination, right? So immune boosting now implies stimulating the immune system. In patients with autism, tick-borne diseases, mold biotoxin illness, immune suppression, immune upregulation, and dysregulation is well documented. In addition, T regulatory cell depletion is seen in patients with biotoxin illness and PANS. Without adequate modulatory effects of Tregs, autoimmunity or an increase thereof would be a logical result. So hence, if it's best to have a knowledgeable practitioner on board, if you have chronic illness and are experimenting with immune boosting. Now let's talk about immune modulation on the other hand. Immune modulation is immune regulation. So immune regulatory herbs help the body achieve a balance with the innate and adaptive branches of the immune system, including your TH1, TH2, TH17, B cells and mast cells. Immune modulating herbs that reduce inflammation may help downregulate the autoimmune response as well. Several herbs have been traditionally used for this purpose, also have been investigated scientifically to determine their mechanisms of action. Some of them would include herbs like hops, artemisia, reishi mushroom, ashwagandha, nettles, Chinese skullcap, to name a few. You know, these important herbs may have a role in decreasing inflammation, along with decreasing the overzealous autoimmune response. And herbs that display this combined behavior are herbs like boswellia, green tea, ginger, turmeric, white willow. And when I said boswellia, I meant, you know, boswellia serrata. Stephania is another one. So the one example would be ashwagandha. Ashwagandha is a well-known, often beloved herb that is widely used. Studies have shown that ashwagandha can significantly suppress the lipopolysaccharide-induced production of pro-inflammatory cytokines like TNF-alpha, IL-1 beta, IL-12, but had no effect on IL-6 production, which is protein and transcript level cytokine. Now, Vytania somnifera or ashwagandha is an immune amphoteric, both stimulating immune response in low immune states and exerting an immune suppressive action on B and T cell activity in hyperimmune or autoimmune states, you know, through this protein and transcription level action. So read the labels, avoid products with these herbs. When I say these herbs, I mean the immune boosting herbs. If you have Lyme disease, mold illness, autism, or any unresolved chronic illness, mm-hmm. caregivers and unaffected family members can certainly utilize immune boosting herbs. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. It just highlights the need for some knowledgeable practitioner in what stage of illness someone might be. And we'll probably touch on that when we talk about the order in which you like to introduce elements of your treatments. I was just wondering, you sort of spoke a little bit about the HLA-DR susceptibility, and I was wondering what sort of person falls ill with mold and biotoxin illness in your experience. Can you speak a little bit more on the genetic susceptibility of these people, and also kind of what other lifestyle or environmental factors might also influence someone's gene expression?
Sure. The genetically susceptible 24% of the population with the HLA-DR that I explained earlier are the ones who get the sickest and experience almost immediate and far more severe symptoms than the non-susceptible ones, who are then able to clear these biotoxins. At the core of why one person becomes ill from this exposure and another doesn't is their gene susceptibility or predisposition, what is built into their DNA. Every person's innate immune system is personal and genetically coded, thus it works differently for each of us. When the body is faced with a foreign substance, it immediately begins to process, recognize it, determine if it's good or bad, a friend or foe, and throw it into the antigen presenting mechanism we spoke about, which will normally generate a pretty effective antibody response. If the body determines the substance is a foe, it will develop antibodies to bind these substances. Normally, the next time a non-mold susceptible person walks into a water damaged building, his bodies will generate antibodies which will target the antigen and clear it out fast. Mm-hmm. That protection from so-called acquired immune responses just as doesn't happen in moldy patients with the genetic susceptibility. So it becomes a vicious cycle. The foreign substances stay in the body, causing the immune system to constantly fight back. This causes so much inflammation in the body that it leads to chronic illness and the occurrence of many symptoms affecting multiple organ systems in the body, from your brains, joints, weight regulation, hormonal regulation, sleep cycle, skin, all the way to the gut and soft tissues. Pretty much our entire being can suffer due to friendly fire from our own innate immune system.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that sort of explains why you've seen families or in partners, sometimes one person's very, very sick and the other person has no symptoms at all. But when you test them, they're both, you know, equally exposed to those biotoxins or water damaged buildings, for example. So yes. Your work actually mentions a specific order of treatment for biotoxin illness. So we know that, you know, some clients, sensitive clients, can have really strong reactions if certain elements are introduced too quickly or in the wrong order. So I was wondering, what are some common sort of rookie errors that you've seen occur in applying these treatment protocols?
Yes, and that is actually connected with the part of your earlier question I failed to answer, is lifestyle and environmental factors that can affect gene expression. So if I may.
Yeah, go ahead. Absolutely.
I find it important to ascertain toxins, infections, and traumas in a patient's past and current history. As you may know, the two stages of gene expression are, one, transcription, the production of messenger RNA or mRNA, and the processing of the resultant mRNA molecule, which is translation, the use of the mRNA information to direct protein synthesis. Now, stress alone can cause novel DNA modifications in the brain that may lead to neurological problems. It will be highly beneficial for practitioners who deal with epigenetic triggers, toxins, methylation, if they understood the concepts of what's called histone methylation as well. Histones are proteins that are critical in the packing of DNA into the cell, into chromatin and chromosomes. They're also very important for regulation of genes. Certain epigenetic changes, such as adequate DNA methylation and histone modification, help a cell control gene expression by precisely turning genes either on or off. A histone methylation and histone demethylation are epigenetic modifications that have the power to reduce or bolster gene expression. Epigenetics can be affected by exposure to triggers like metals, heavy metals, air pollution, water pollution, benzene compounds, organic pollutants, electromagnetic radiation, chemical, xenobiotic, and endocrine disruptor compounds in water or in the atmosphere. There's also herbicides, pesticides, mycotoxins, actinomycetes, bacterial endotoxins, volatile organic compounds, and other potential environmental stressors are all capable of changing epigenetic status. Now, as far as keeping Herxheimer reactions or intensification reactions, die-off reactions, detox reactions, keeping those minimum, which every practitioner and every patient desires, it is important to proceed step by step. It's explained very well in the book, you know, my entire BioNexus protocol. I don't really advocate self-treatment, unless you're a practitioner, of course, since it's a very complex scenario with both branches of your immune system off track. So a good knowledgeable practitioner, or at least if you are a practitioner, if you have a mentor, work together with your mentor. And, you know, it's certainly possible to achieve remission in most of these cases.
Absolutely. And I think even with a practitioner, self-treating, sort of, knowing when to hold back or push forward can be really difficult. So, you know, definitely working with your own practitioner is helpful in that. How does someone know they're having a detox or Herxheimer reaction? We sort of warn our patients this could happen. I think some of them are sort of they're not really sure what to expect. Would it be an exacerbation in symptoms, or would it typically be feeling quite ill for periods of time?
Well, the way to look at that is a detox reaction occurs when trying to add in a detox remedy, and a Herxheimer or die-off reaction occurs during antimicrobial therapy. Now, the most common rookie errors in trying to approach these treatment protocols is trying to explain the entire clinical picture within the confines of your personal esteemed specialization. A methylation expert may try to focus first on detox pathways as the panacea to all of the patient's maladies. A Lyme specialist might try and explain it from the and treat it from the perspective of infectious disease, and so on, if you catch my drift. So more often than not, it's all of that and more. It's all interconnected by fragile immune mechanisms with multi-organ pathologies. So it is important to first kind of nourish your body, make sure that any deficiencies are corrected, make sure that your cells are well-nourished, your gut is supported before you proceed to detox. And then, you know, there are several steps to be followed in order to minimize. So if your patient has, if you have provided all of this nutritional support, multi-organ support as well to your patient, and then they are experiencing reactions, then you can easily classify them into detox reactions or Herxheimer reactions and add additional support to the body as needed.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a gentle and sensitive process, and some people have to go really, really slowly, as you've probably experienced in your clinic too. I was just wondering, some of our clients actually have, the more complex ones can go on to develop histamine intolerance or mast cell activation. Is that also common in your practice? And what's going on with the immune system here when excessive histamine is being produced and we're unable to break this down?
So mast cells are part of our innate immune response. They belong to the first responder group of cells known as sentinel cells, which are our first line of defense against microbes or threats to the host. When unwanted substances like microbes or toxins become attached to the innate immune receptors, the mast cells will release pro-inflammatory mediators like histamine. Histamine's not the only one. There's leukotrienes, there's prostaglandins, et cetera. So these are all signaling molecules that help further the inflammation response. Additionally, mast cells can work with other cells like T and B lymphocytes to enhance activation and migration by cell-to-cell interactions or secreted products. So T cells are cells, as we explained, of the adaptive immune system, and T regulatory cells can induce tolerance and control autoimmunity, which is very important. Mast cells, unfortunately, can also suppress these regulatory T cell activity. So when you understand this, and I've simplified it a great deal, it becomes a bit clearer why mast cell activation occurs and stays. As long as the person is exposed to microbial and other triggers like stress, food, alcohol, VOCs, you know, that I just spoke of, sometimes even changes to the gut microbiome are a trigger. The longer the exposure, the longer the innate immune activation, the greater are the chances of developing an auto-inflammatory disorder where the mast cells become activated quicker, sometimes called as I wouldn't call it autoimmune. So auto-inflammatory would work better, where the mast cells become activated quicker with more triggers and the histamine cascade stays triggered longer. Now, prolonged exposure to histamine creates exotoxins that invite quorum bacteria to create biofilms. Right. Now, once there is creation of biofilms, this enables the virulence factor expression and additional biofilm formation. I mean, to put it simply, quorum sensing is that it's a communication mechanism between organisms to communicate threat. So these organisms then are better able to have a defensive response and persist in the host body, create biofilms. So they are essentially talking to each other to help each other survive. Now, in my treatment, my approach is the BioNexus line of herbal blends and formulas. Many key blends are stem cell enhanced. They are also a tri-doshic Ayurvedically, you see. So it's not as simple as reducing histamines. We need to support ourselves from within, address the root cause, eliminate toxin triggers, and much more. For cellular support and hydration, I find cell salts, gemotherapy, oligotherapy to be especially useful. You know, it's interesting that obviously patient compliance is very important, you know, progressing slowly with you need to be patient with patients. I find many may need intermittent brief pharmaceutical product help to help with certain acute symptoms. And that is absolutely fine. Finding a happy medium is often best practice. You know, I have a large number of patients that have been caught in the symptom suppression cycle with pharmaceutical drugs without ever feeling really well from within. So they wish to transition to plant-based treatments, and a gentle weaning off process is essential so you don't end up with multiple chemical sensitivities, mast cell activation, and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for the answer. I think that's hugely helpful. I was also just wondering about patients who, a lot of patients who have SIRS or tick-borne infections or tick-borne illnesses, they've been ill for most of their lives. And some of them, we feel that it may even be congenital or developmental. So from your experience in practice, how many of these people can actually go on to have a full recovery? And what sort of unique challenges might they need to overcome?
Borreliosis, Lyme disease, can be sexually transmitted and can also be transmitted in utero from mother to child. I do see quite a few of both. Pregnancy that is carried to full term in a water-damaged building and the resultant effects on the child is something I've been monitoring in my practice for over 2 years. In some instances, it's a double whammy. A mother with Lyme, pregnant in a water-damaged building. These moms are usually unaware of their Lyme disease or biotoxin illness with seemingly unrelated symptoms like, you know, like allergic rhinitis, Hashimoto's, CFSME, fibromyalgia, hormonal dysregulation, and so on. They fail to connect as to what really is the underlying cause. So the newborns demonstrate classic symptoms of multi-organ inflammation like jaundice, pallor, colic, sleep disorder, sleep apnea, cardiac rhythm abnormalities, gastrointestinal distress. Many go on and are diagnosed with autism, ADHD, sensory integration disorders, anxiety, and so on. What I find is that early intervention is key. I mean, children in all age groups demonstrate gains once the underlying medical issues are addressed for sure. But I find younger the better when it comes to full recovery, especially with respect to the pace of beneficial gains, laying down of healthy lifestyle choices like diet. One example is I have a 3-year-old patient from the Middle East whose parents brought him to me when he was just 22 months. Vaccine injured, diagnosed on the spectrum, regressed, and in poor health. Within 7 to 8 months of treatment, this child is 75% back on track. And of course, his family is overjoyed.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. I was just, when you were talking about that, I was just thinking of how early, I think in the UK in particular, you know, we wait for quite a few milestones to be missed before they get the diagnosis of autistic spectrum. And that sounds pretty late in terms of opportunity for intervention. So I think, yeah, just awareness and the full medical history and family mother's history as well is super important. I guess going on to nutrition, how important is diet for you? And do you have a favorite diet that you like to use with your clients, or will it be, again, highly individualized to their culture, to their individual sensitivities?
It is always individualized to the culture. You know, you may know that I am, my mom was Greek-Irish, my dad was Indian, from India, as is. So, you know, I was brought up with a wonderful, holistic, Ayurvedic, naturopathic culture growing up as well. So yes, you know, definitely one needs to be sensitive to local practices as well. You know, there are several diets that are very helpful. The point is not lifelong diets, but as a tool for immune regulation to buy us a few months to build up, for me, the BioNexus protocol. The initial focus is on cellular and mucosal stability, hydration, and repair. So I have a few proprietary techniques that I've shared with many practitioners in the US, UK, and other countries, but are also in the book. Now, diets like WALS, Feingold, SCD, that is the specific carbohydrate diet, the AIP or the autoimmune paleo diet are all helpful and are suggested based on individual patient requirements at the time of evaluation. One important thing I like to stress is to keep it organic, you know, like as much as possible, and non-GMO, you know, away from things like glyphosate, which can be so devastating. And again, is it possible globally? Not really. In most countries, the awareness is growing. In some countries, it's just either not available or just too cost prohibitive. So, you know, we just incorporate detoxification mechanisms accordingly. But once the patient begins to heal, once you start addressing the underlying medical issues, it not just medical, it's medical, psychological, spiritual issues, you start to see gut healing occurring, and that lasts. That like you know, for example, with my son, we were able to get rid of allergies, like allergies to tree nuts, to peanuts, to sesame seeds, to things like, you know, spices like garlic. I mean, it was ridiculous. Why would you be allergic to garlic? But of course, it was the PSD mechanism, the sulfur, etc. But we are fine now. And being able to add in things like tree nuts and peanuts to some people, it could be mind-boggling, but we are fine.
Oh, that's that's amazing work. And it shows the importance of kind of the step-by-step introducing dietary elements and nutritional elements at the right time. To kind of move on from that, how do you work with food limitations in autistic spectrum clients? And I've had a few clients myself who'd only eat certain textures or maybe only 4 to 5 foods in their diet. You know, sometimes even adults are sort of the same. So what sort of underlying issues spring to mind when someone has very restricted eating patterns? And then how do you, I guess, go on to broaden their food repertoire?
You know, I absolutely do not believe in advocating restrictive diets. Mm-hmm. Food allergy testing is of very limited value in my practice. Understanding why your immune system is lacking tolerance is the key. I mean, tolerance at a central level and at a peripheral level is built into your immune system. That's how your body was designed by the universe. Sometimes a specific diet is nearly impossible due to extreme issues, like, you know, you mentioned autistic children with a lot of oral sensory problems, other sensory issues. So in that scenario, it's best to stay with whatever the person or the child can eat and focus on identifying what the core issues are. It's been consistently observed, as I mentioned, that once all microbial triggers are eliminated, targeted toxin binders are in place, environmental remediation completed, thyroid and adrenals are supported, gut cellular repair is underway, over 90% of parents and patients report tremendous behavioral, sensory, and food reactivity gains with an expansion of palate. I will as well. I'll often hear from many parents and patients that it's almost as if, you know, the autistic child, as if she was eating to feed the bugs. All the bad choices with the sugars and the carbs. But now that they're gone, her body knows what's good and she's eating vegetables without a fuss for the first time ever. I mean, that's the best feedback ever. Happier and healthier patient.
Yeah.
And happier, you know, mom and dad as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I guess in terms of treatment, you've been trained in allopathic as well as naturopathic medicine, and you currently use an all-natural approach in your clinic. So what advantages do you feel herbal medicine has over pharmaceuticals? And I guess second part to that question is, under what circumstances is it appropriate to be using a more conventional approach?
Ah, okay. So pharmaceuticals have a very important role to play in acute care medicine and also in some long-term scenarios. For example, studies have shown that very low-dose minocycline is beneficial for those with late-stage rheumatoid arthritis. We all know about the use of low-dose aspirin in cardiovascular health. It's best to have a good working knowledge of all tools available for the patient, should the situation so demand. At the same time, it's also important to be aware of drug-induced nutrient deficiency so the patient is supported accordingly. Plant-based lifestyle is a way of life, isn't it? You know, patients who come to me are those that are either plant-based themselves or those that wish to transition from conventional treatments to natural remedies. Plants have an incredible repertoire of healing compounds that they so generously share with us. I express my respect and gratitude daily. One of the most awe-inspiring event for me, Claire, you'll enjoy hearing this, was to be in the presence of a 300-year-old Bacopa monnieri tree in Kew Gardens in London.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I know the one.
You know the one. Yeah. I mean, it's majestic, old, wise, and oh my gosh, such amazing energy. You know, I was wishing I could have taken a branch back home to make some awesome tincture.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was, I often say to my clients, plants have been here longer than we have, way longer than we have. And they've, you know, evolved these bacteria and these kind of infections that we're trying to fight. So they have, you know, developed their own immunology, their own resistance and the resilience to those infections. So yeah, there's a lot we can gain from ingesting, you know, those.
You know, I must add, I get excited, you know, when it comes to herbs, but, you know, respectfully and lovingly created herbal formulations go beyond their intended use into other areas of wellness. You know, I've recently created, speaking of, you know, being excited, I've recently created a delicious and amazing new blend. And I call it the Daily Om Blend. That'll be a fantastic addition, you know, to my toolbox. It's a multifactorial daily wellness tonic for all age groups, especially those patients that are on maintenance, caregivers, family members who are not necessarily sick, but wish to maintain their health in a natural way. So this way, you know, conventional medical training, naturopathic training, they both kind of come together to establish a happy medium.
Amazing. I look forward to using that one in practice. I guess it'll be really good for preventative for anyone who's worried about, I guess, current pandemic and just having some gentle sort of immune support there too. With the people that enter your clinic, what's the sort of expect? This might be quite a hard question to answer in retrospect, but what's the expected recovery time for someone with a diagnosis of biotoxin illness? And I guess, is their journey, are there many ups and downs in there in that recovery process?
It's possible to have an idea of a treatment timeline only after the first couple follow-ups. Once the patient's trajectory has been established, the response, the herxing, and so on. On an average, I've observed that once the patient is able to build up to their full protocol, it can take anywhere between 2 weeks to 2 months to see a significant difference in their health. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a number of factors act as variables like age, duration of illness, severity of condition, are they still being exposed, you know, and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. And for clients who feel they might be plateauing or fluctuating quite wildly, do you have any advice for these clients?
Fluctuations are to be expected. You know, everybody experiences ups and downs, flare-ups, re-exposures, two steps forward and one step backwards, but it's still progress. Mm. I mean, life happens, inadvertent exposures, relapses do happen. Recovery can be pretty sawtooth, but the light at the end of the tunnel is so amazingly bright, I find sometimes, that most patients experience glimpses of this along the way, and this helps to maintain compliance. Now, plateauing is also to be expected if it makes sense clinically. Okay, you know, it's important to think analytically that if, for example, an autistic child had a good spurt of behavioral gains, it's normal for the body to step back, rest up a bit, reboot before starting the next repair process. Mm-hmm. You know, I had one adult complain of plateauing, and upon questioning, I found that just as soon as she started feeling better, she went full on into her landscaping business, trimming hedges, hauling dirt, operating machinery. I mean, like what? So I realize feeling better after years of chronic fatigue is amazing, but you need to be gentle with your body. Give it time to, fully heal. It is important to check for reinfection, but it's also important to give it some time to heal.
Yeah. And I guess the conversation around pacing, because I think people don't often realize that they're actually doing more because they have more energy, and kind of going over that and examining that with them, they actually realize that their body is in so much of a better place too. Yeah. Kind of moving on from that, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the current pandemic and sort of any clinical trends you're picking up on. So have you seen any long-term effects in your clinic from COVID-19, things like long COVID presenting in any of your patients?
Well, I've been infected twice. The first time was a bit intense, but after a week of moderately intense symptoms, I was back at work. The second, now mind you, I'm obviously, you know, on a complete herbal protocol. The second time, I hardly even noticed anything other than a slight headache, some fatigue for a day or two. I have 50 plus patients exposed in all age groups from 2.5 years old to 84 years old. They all pulled through very well. The trend I've noticed is those with clean diets, clean indoor air quality, good herbal support, lifestyle where fresh air, sunshine is a must every day, have done really well. Again, you know, nothing specific. It's hard to distinguish from chronic Lyme. It's hard to distinguish long COVID from chronic Lyme and CIRS anyways. I mean, especially CIRS, right? Due to the intense respiratory and inflammatory components in both the ARDS, the acute respiratory distress syndrome in COVID-19 patients, and the CIRS. One example, you know, for a clinician to understand would be the vascular endothelial growth factor, which, as you may know, is a signal protein produced by cells that stimulate growth of new blood vessels in order, you know, for gas delivery, in order to supply oxygen to the tissues when blood circulation becomes inadequate. So in a healthy body, decreased blood flow in capillaries resulting in low oxygen supply will automatically trigger the release of the hypoxia-inducible factor, the HIF. Now, this HIF stimulates the production of VEGF and erythropoietin. So VEGF will increase the blood flow by creating new blood vessels, while EPO or erythropoietin increases production of red blood cells. They both help to increase oxygen supply to the cells. In CIRS, VEGF is suppressed due to high cytokine levels, which causes poor oxygen supply to the tissues and resulting in muscle cramping, headaches, body aches, intense pain, Raynaud's-like toes and fingers, and fatigue. Now, many of these symptoms are very similar to COVID and long COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. And have you noticed any behavioral trends or mental regression with children on the autistic spectrum since lockdown? So, you know, the homeschooling, self-isolating, is that something that you've noticed in your patients? And what do you think is happening to their developing brains without that stimulation?
I've been blessed in that regard with some remarkable mothers and fathers that have kept things stable for their autistic children. Additionally, those on a good, robust herbal protocol have continued to make multifactorial gains. You know, this helps bring joy, motivation, hope for better days ahead for their child. All in all, families have been holding it together rather well. Many have even accomplished successful moves from a water-damaged, moldy residence to a cleaner place. So nothing really works like seeing your child make progress. I mean, it's such a precious feeling for a parent. It gives you strength and wings.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess it's sort of reminiscent of some of our clients who've had ME/CFS for a really long time, and then the pandemic and long COVID happening. I guess, you know, a lot of them were trapped at home without financial help and support for years and decades. So they it will be a really familiar scenario rather than a completely new one for those families. What advice for patients or parents would you give to if they are noticing a decline in health due to the pandemic? Is it keeping it quite simple, or is there something specific that they could follow?
Patients on targeted herbals should feel secure and confident that their naturopathic practitioner has them covered. Yeah. If the decline in health is due to COVID or fear of exposure to COVID, then there are fantastic immune supportive herbal protocols. If it's due to the stress of dealing with the tremendous lifestyle changes due to the pandemic, the anxiety, once again, in the hands of a good practitioner, you can have access to plant-based options. There are many spiritual neurological herbs that can calm the mind, balance neurotransmitters, help with mental anguish, pain, overall relaxation of the mind. Now, the best nutritional advice to get the best out of any immune and detoxification symptom would be to eat organic, locally grown, in season, eat a well-balanced rainbow. Eat a rainbow a day dipped in beautiful, pure oils is what I like to say. Simple home-cooked meals, you know, prepared with love. Avoid sugar, avoid overeating. Eat to nourish your body. Mm-hmm. One thing that I've observed is if you stop eating when you're like 60 to 75% full, it takes about 15, 20 minutes postprandial for the brain to register satiety. Yeah. Most continue eating if it tastes good and they overwhelm the system. I mean, if in North America, avoid gluten, cow, dairy, even if organic. Drink clean, structured water. Live a clutter-free life in a manageable size residence with good air filters. And I would recommend to spend at least 20 to 30 minutes a day in nature, like fresh air, sunshine.
Yeah, absolutely. Completely agree with all of that. And speaking of some of the fear and anxiety around COVID, and sort of touching on trauma, but how much of a role do you feel trauma plays in some of the more complex cases of autism or biotoxin illness?
Well, it's a family tragedy when it comes to autism. Often, you know, it's a similar journey when it comes to chronic illness, both for the patient and the caregivers. I mean, there is obviously PTSD type scenario, emotions, frantic denial, grief, depression, trauma from all of this. So let's look at the neurobiology of trauma real quick. You know, for the brain to cope with the situation, It needs to take in stimuli that are coming in from the outside world. Then allow the vision of what's happening, what was the diagnosis, what it implies, the hearing of what's going on, the smell, the taste, the touch, the five senses, along with what's going on, the sixth sense, the body. All of that input is basically energy and information flow through the nervous system. Mm. Then, right, then your nervous system has to take it and do something with it. It comes down to having the ability to cope with multiple incoming stimuli, like rapidly incoming stimuli, a sensory overload that hits the nervous system head on. For an average person, it would simply overwhelm their capacity to encode these things into memory, to assimilate, reason why, and try and understand why. But also, we need to look at the hormonal response to stress and to trauma. During trauma, there's cortisol and adrenaline. They both have a direct impact on the brain. You affect not just the synapses, neurons, myelin, but also the epigenetic regulation that determine how genes are expressed in the brain. That is what we need to understand about our patients who go through trauma, or if we've been through trauma and PTSD. Epigenetic impacts of trauma appear to involve alterations in parts of the genome that would otherwise be preventing inflammation. Mm. So many of the disorders of stress are disorders of inflammation, just like autism and biotoxin illness, you know, neurotransmitters, stress hormones, bilateral hemispheric sensory integration. I mean, it's a biochemical assault on the body, and treatment becomes equally complex.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you find it's really important to kind of support the vagal tone and vagus nerve activity with these clients in combination with the herbal and nutritional protocols?
Yes, you know, trauma looks different in adults and children. I mean, the actual physiological response is similar, but the manifestations would certainly be different depending on various factors. One important factor, Claire, would be if the child is autistic and nonverbal. Mm. So usually a few modalities together are best for the approach for sustained relief: spiritual herbalism, celestial herbalism, cell salt therapy, counseling, especially with a therapist who knows modalities like tapping, EFT, that emotional freedom technique, the EMDR, the eye movement technique, transcendental meditation. Other modalities that help would be looking into a practitioner that understands the polyvagal theory, the associated craniosacral body work, Tomatis sound therapy, the listening program, the hemisync, binaural beats, sensory integration, particularly proprioception and body awareness, heart math, and acupuncture, to name a few. You know, one good one is the Art of Living Foundation has a wonderfully healing spiritual meditative course called as the Happiness Program. Makes you happy. It works.
Brilliant. And can sort of children and adults both do this program? Yes. Fantastic. What for you makes a good patient-client or patient-clinician relationship?
Compassion, trust, mutual respect, both ways. Mm. I feel that a practitioner who has a bioenergetic background usually feels a spiritual connection as well. I have numerous patients who are emotionally ultra fragile and vulnerable because they are also empaths. And it takes a special practitioner to help empaths back to health. I feel, you know, there are higher dimensions to be addressed with the inner and outer wellness with empaths. Mm-hmm. with special needs children, it's important for a practitioner to put their own ego aside and listen to a mother's intuition about their child. The beautiful nonverbal energetic connection that exists between them. Additionally, I feel it is our duty to help the caregivers as well. Mothers and caregivers become so used to giving selflessly They often forget to nourish their own selves. Many, I find, are suffering from chronic illnesses themselves, along with PTSD, for years on end. It's important to support these often forgotten caregivers. You know, I mean, often all it takes is a quick extra 15 minutes of your time after a patient appointment to help their caregivers with their health concerns.
Absolutely. I think we find in our CFS fibromyalgia sort of client group, a lot of these people are carers or mothers or helper type people. So yeah, it's absolutely essential to support the whole family structure. Finally, I've heard you speak on the gift of illness before, and for so many people who haven't made it to the out the other end of their illnesses yet, can you offer some sort of closing thoughts on this?
Certainly. I feel that your outer world reflects your inner world. With an inner world full of strength, conviction, patience, self-knowledge, the outer world begins to transform, to manifest what we set out to achieve. You know, off the beaten path, not trying to keep up with the Joneses, but rather making your own way forward. In chronic illness, many times it's an invisible issue. Inner damage is invisible to people outside, and hardly anybody truly understands the real suffering that's going on. Could be autism, CFSME, CIRS, Lyme disease, so on. Many are told it's all in their head. You know, myself included, when I was convinced what I was seeing with my son was perhaps not really autism, you know, mother's intuition is a powerful thing. Innately programmed mother's intuition, and many of my patients' moms tell me the same thing as well. Daily interaction tells you there's a lot of light behind those eyes that look lost. There are glimpses of their true nature, immense potential. Mm-hmm. Don't let anyone distract you from your beliefs. I had to make tremendous sacrifices along the way, but I met and learned from amazing masters like Klinghardt, Buhner, Shoemaker, Jones, Jemsek, who not only helped heal my child, but also helped regain my own health and vitality. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the heart needs to be broken so it opens to let the light in. And the light that entered transformed my life, my work, and the lives of so many that I've that have helped from the knowledge I gained on my journey. I shall be eternally grateful for that blessing of illness. You know, I mean, if the attitude is that of gratitude and humility, the prayers for strength and resolution of our challenges seem to be that much stronger. In conclusion, Claire, I'm sure you'll agree what a privilege it is to do the work that we do, to help people navigate through chronic illness, to keep hope alive, especially with current global events.
Absolutely. That's an absolutely perfect answer. Dr. Deshaw, thank you so much for this conversation. I'm sure it'll be one that people will listen to over and over. For anyone who wants to find out more about your work, so where would you direct them to in first instances?
That would be my website is www.bionexushealth.com, bionexushealth.com.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Dr. Deshaw.
You're welcome. Pleasure.